The law has become more lax when it comes to sentencing for drug offenses, but not everyone's enjoying the changes. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. A study from FSU shows there are hundreds of people who are serving long sentences for selling drugs. That's even after the laws have changed. Can a prisoner get shorter time if the laws changed, but not retroactively? Also, Miami leaders believe now is the time to prepare for rising seas and climate change. But really, it all comes down to the taxpayers. And why are there hundreds of millions of dollars for disaster relief being kept from homeowners in Florida? Finally,
I think most economists would suggest that the Super Bowl is roughly a break even.
The Super Bowl is almost here, but how much is South Florida really profiting from the game? All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us today. Hundreds of Florida inmates are currently serving outdated drug sentences that are no longer in state law. An upcoming Florida State University study found women, and specifically Hispanic women, are being disproportionately impacted by these sentences. Why are female prisoners more likely to serve these longer terms? We spoke with Emily Mahoney. She's a reporter for the Tampa Bay Times and Miami Herald in the Tallahassee Bureau. And she told us about the study's findings and how Miami-Dade County is approaching things differently. Emily, take us back to why the original 1990s mandatory minimums law was first passed. I mean, this relates to minimum sentences for drug crimes. What was happening in Florida at that time?
The original law was passed in 1999, and at that time, Florida ranked extremely highly for violent crimes in the nation. And this was a huge concern of the lawmakers up here in Tallahassee. And there were just a lot of high-profile crimes happening as well. One thing that was really concerning was that state leaders were worried that this was going to affect tourism, that Florida was earning a reputation as a place where there was a lot of violent crime, a lot of drug crime, and people might not be as open to coming here anymore. And so in an effort to both keep our residents safe and to keep Florida's reputation alive, they passed a law that, you know, they said would be tough on crime and promised that it would only target big time drug dealers who they said, you know, were kind of wreaking havoc across the state. And we learned later, of course, that that's not exactly what ended up happening.
The law disproportionately impacted some of the state's most vulnerable populations. How did it do that?
It's interesting. It actually, part of it comes from the way that it calculated the weight of the drugs. The way that Florida law works is it counts the weight of an entire pill as if it were all made up of the very powerful opioid drug that is contained as a small percentage in that pill. So, for example, a Vicodin pill, which is hydrocodone, which is, you know, a controlled substance and a very powerful prescription opioid, that's made up of about 300 milligrams of acetaminophen with only 5 to 10 milligrams of hydrocodone. But yet the law counts it as if all of those milligrams are hydrocodone. And so the result of that was kind of an accidental overweighting of prescription drugs over street drugs, so that people who were selling or possess or illegally possessing small amounts of prescription painkillers such as hydrocodone and oxycodone were actually facing much harsher penalties than people who possessed or illegally sold small amounts of things like cocaine. And so a recent report that is actually about to be released found that the number of inmates who are currently sitting in prison serving these outdated sentences because they were sentenced before the legislature kind of fixed this problem in the law. We know that there's about up to 935 of them. They're strongly disproportionately female. They're about twice as likely to be a woman than the average Florida inmate. And they're also much more likely to be Hispanic than the average Florida inmate. And I think what's most interesting of all is they came from a small handful of counties, mostly smaller rural counties, which shows that there were areas in Florida that used this strict mandatory minimum sentence much more often and much more harshly than other areas, even areas like Miami-Dade, which kind of became famous for having you know, drug problems in the 80s and things. So it's kind of an unequal application of justice.
One of those prisoners, Jamara De Leon, was the focus of one of your stories. She's currently at a privately run women's prison in the Panhandle. She's serving a 15-year sentence for a drug crime.
In 2011, someone asked me if I had any pills. I told that person no. They constantly contacted me. I didn't think I was going to do 15 years. My babies were 4 months old. I had twin boys. My daughter, she's 5 years old. She was 5 years old at the time. She's eight now.
So, Emily, how did she end up in jail?
Well, she sold a grand total of 48 pills, hydrocodone or Vicodin pills, to an undercover cop in 2011. And she did that. It was her first time offense, her first time drug crime. She has no criminal record other than a couple traffic violations until this point. And she was convinced to do it by somebody who she found out later was a confidential informant who was helping police because he had his own drug charges that he was trying to avoid serving time for. And so she was actually owed money by this confidential informant, and he convinced her in order to get her money back, she needed to sell these prescription pills to somebody he told her was a drug dealer. And she did it twice. She sold 48 pills in 2011, and she was eventually charged with drug trafficking in hydrocodone. And because of a problem in her first trial and kind of some delay, a delay in her initial arrest, she actually wasn't sentenced until 2016, which by that point, the legislature had fixed the problem with the law that I mentioned earlier. And so she thought she was only going to get 3 years in prison because at that point, that's what the law said. The law said, you know, if for her crime, 48 hydrocodone pills, that's only a 3-year mandatory sentence.
How do prosecutors calculate the length of drug sentences?
Well, in this case, this is a mandatory minimum sentence. So there was an instance here where she was offered a plea deal before she went to trial by the prosecution. And they said, you know, you can take 3 years if you just plead guilty. And she actually refused that. And, you know, it's something that I know she regrets now because she, you know, she felt that she had this true defense that, you know, she was convinced to do this by a confidential informant. And there's actually a legal term for that. It's called entrapment, where police entrap you by getting you to commit a crime that you would not have otherwise committed without their influence. But it's a difficult thing to prove. And ultimately, the jury was not convinced that she was entrapped. And so, you know, after that, the prosecution just asked for what the law said. And that was the mandatory minimum sentence of 15 years. You know, the judge really had no choice in the matter. After she was found guilty, that was, you know, the prosecution just asked for what the law dictated.
I'm speaking with Emily Mahoney, reporter for the Tampa Bay Times and Miami Herald in the Tallahassee Bureau. Hundreds of Florida inmates are currently serving outdated drug sentences that are no longer in state law. You can find Mahoney's story on our social media at WLRN Sundial. As you were touching on this, Emily, on the Project on Accountable Justice that you had reported on some of the research, a criminal justice policy nonpartisan group from FSU, it shows, again, as you had said, that women and specifically Hispanic women are more likely to serve outdated drug sentences in Florida prisons. But do we know why? Why is that? Why that group?
Well, it's an interesting question. I think part of it has to do with the fact that there are a few select counties who used these sentences and much more heavily. And one of them is Osceola County, which has a pretty sizable Hispanic population. But when it comes to women, why women? That has a really interesting answer. And partially, it you have to blow it out to the national conversation. Since 1978, the number of women in state prisons nationwide has grown by more than 800%, which is kind of a shocking number. That's double the pace that the male population in state prisons has grown in that same amount of time. You know, I've talked to some researchers about why that is, and a lot of them have said that it is the war on drugs, that women are more likely to get nabbed for drug crimes. And there's a lot of different ideas as to why that is. One of them, Professor Carla LaRoche at FSU, pointed to the fact that one in four women experienced sexual or domestic violence before they were eventually put in prison. And so, you know, traumatic experiences like that might lead them to self-medicate with drugs and things like that. We also see examples of women who are associated with, you know, boyfriends who are involved in drug crimes and things like that, also getting caught up in that. So there's a lot of interesting ideas as to why that is.
I also wanted to come back to what you had said earlier. Part of your reporting is the fact that different counties dished out sentences differently. And Miami-Dade County was really different from counties in rural parts of the state. Why?
Well, and that's a really interesting question. I think it really gets to the heart of a really important issue in our criminal justice system in Florida in general, because this is not the only example of an issue where counties are treating the justice system differently. You know, this is an ongoing problem. In juvenile arrest rates, for example, counties also treat that differently. Some counties arrest many more juveniles than others, who will kind of put them through the civil system and fine them because they want them to avoid actually going into the criminal justice system before they turn 18. You know, whether drug crimes will result in treatment or incarceration also has broad differences depending on what county you live in. And so I think that, you know, researchers have said that that stems from a few different things. First of all, rural counties might have fewer resources for drug crimes, for example. They might have fewer rehab centers, fewer mental health facilities that judges can refer their defendants to rather than putting them behind bars. But it's also a different in mindset. I think that in northern Florida, they might have a more tough on crime mindset than places like Miami-Dade, where because there are just so many more people and there are, you know, there is more prevalent major drug crimes going on, they will kind of brush off the small stuff, the smaller low level drug crimes, in a way that, you know, a less populous county might not do.
And we go back to like the beginning of this conversation. We're talking about how in the 90s there was this let's get tough on drugs, tough on crime mentality. But when did you start to see the shift, especially in Tallahassee with lawmakers, that maybe that's not the way to go?
Well, the problem in this particular law was amended in 2014. And so, you know, that wasn't really all that long ago. And what's interesting here is I'm still a Tallahassee reporter reporting on the legislature, and we're still having these conversations now. I mean, I covered a bill that had a hearing in the Senate that would allow judges to not impose mandatory minimums for drug crimes, which is, you know, exactly what we're talking about here, if there are certain circumstances. So this is, you know, a person's first time offense and they don't have any violent felony history and such like that. You know, then the judge, if in cases like this where they don't want to sentence somebody to a 15-year minimum because they just don't feel that it fits the crime in this instance, they would be allowed to depart from that. Florida's tough on crime era is slowly starting to end, but it's a very slow and a very ongoing process.
And the tricky part to this is you talk about that amendment, you know, again, granting the legislature this new authority, and it was approved in 2018, but you've got inmates, they see this as a sign of hope, and yet it's out of reach.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And so that's a really important thread of this story as well. So like you said, in 2018, voters passed a constitutional amendment, which requires 60% approval from the voters, not an easy threshold to get, that deleted the prohibition on retroactively applying changes in law to old cases, which is exactly what was kind of hanging up the legislature before in helping these hundreds of inmates that we're talking about.
And Jamare De Leon is watching very carefully, as are a lot of people watching very carefully what lawmakers are doing.
Yes, exactly. I know she told me that actually they have a live stream of the legislature in a TV in the prison. And a lot of inmates in this particular prison will watch what the legislature is doing just day to day, which I find pretty incredible.
That was Emily Mahoney, reporter for the Tampa Bay Times and Miami Herald in the Tallahassee Bureau. You can find Mahoney's story about outdated prison sentences in the state of Florida on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Well, still to come, what will it cost to make South Florida more resilient to the coming changes from climate risk? And are you ready to pay for that? It's coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, Miami is facing a lot of challenges from nature. 2019 was a record-breaking year for heat. Sea level rise projections continue to grow. And as we saw with Hurricane Dorian, we are facing increasingly more powerful storms. As the climate continues to warm, our region will continue to look drastically different. Miami leaders want to protect the future of the city, as all of South Florida. And they believe there's a plan for that. It's called the Miami Forever Climate Ready Initiative. That's what they believe is the key. Joining me now is WLRN environmental reporter Jenny Stiletovich. Jenny, always great to have you.
Hi, thank you.
Okay. Miami Forever Climate Initiative. It's a mouthful. What is this?
So this is the city's resilience plan that they've rolled out. They've been working on it for about a year now. They've met with the Urban Land Institute. They've held about 8 neighborhood meetings with people around the city. And it is, a lot of it is what we've heard about before, but now they say they have officially made it part of the city's strategy. And within City Hall, all departments will have a chunk of this, and they'll have to do monthly and quarterly updates on the progress of the work they've been assigned. And that the plan is in flux too, like as they move along, as Jean Gilbert said, it's a train they're building as they move.
Yeah, you've had the chance to talk to city leaders, to a lot of people for years, and I want to know, what do they think is going to happen to our region in the next 50, 60, 70 years?
They have a long laundry list. You know, the flooding is the main, that's what we hear about the most is flooding. But there's health impacts. There are doctors who are worried about increased infectious diseases from more mosquitoes and higher temperatures. There's our water supply and saltwater intrusion. There is stress on these old coastal sewer lines and stormwater pipes. I mean, it will be a challenge to both live here, and then our surroundings are going to be changing. There could be more invasive species as the climate changes and it gets warmer. Our native plants and animals may suffer, and that makes room for invasive species.
Do you get the sense that they're optimistic that they can protect the area? That they can protect us from rising seas?
I think it depends on who you ask.
Okay.
But I think everybody recognizes that this is an immense challenge. I mean, I don't think there's any doubt that everybody has recognized
that. Initiative says that numerous stakeholders and agencies are involved. Like who? Who are they? Who are these stakeholders? Who are these agencies?
So the county. Is involved, the South Florida Water Management District, all the cities, anybody who is going to have a price to pay, has infrastructure.
State agencies as well?
So the Water Management District, late last year, I think, estimated that just maintaining coastal pumps that are outdated, we have all these aging pumps, it's going to cost them up to $70 million a year. So everybody... I think government agency is going to have to fork over some money to pay to address this.
We're going to talk about money in a minute. All right, so the plan looks at 3 big challenges: heat, sea level rise, and storms. So let's start with heat. We could be facing more days with temperatures that feel like it's over 100. How does the city prepare for this? Because they've broken it up into everything from roads, housing, stormwater, to parks, they've tried to find many different ways the city can prepare for all of these challenges. When it comes to heat, what are we talking about?
So they have some simple goals, like increase the tree canopy in the city by 30%. I think that was supposed to be done by the end of this year. They're also making it easier for buildings to have solar and install solar panels. They've waived permitting fees for that. They want any building, new building over 50,000 square feet has to be LEED Silver certified, I believe. So they're trying to make the buildings more efficient. The city is in the process of doing its own assessment of its carbon emissions and coming up with a way to mitigate that. But as Jane Gilbert explained to me last week, that's a lot. That's kind of complicated, and it's going to take some time.
Is it putting pressure on developers, or are they on board with it?
I think that's a little mixed. I mean, I think some developers are on board. In some ways, they're being forced to come on board, for example, with this LEED certification requirement for buildings over 50,000 square feet. I think it depends on the location and the kind of building.
I would just think that it's an investment into the future. You'd hope your investment's going to last into the future. Another challenge that they mentioned, sea level rise, of course. Are people who doubted finally coming around to understanding the challenges that we're facing with flooding that's coming in the next few decades?
When you say people, do you mean the general public or you mean
general
like elected and politicians and government
both.
Officials?
Both.
I feel like governments are definitely coming on board and also because there's more money available too. There's more grants, there's more federal spending, and the public is demanding that these government agencies do things. And also, you know, we've had a bunch of sewer spills. And this aging infrastructure is forcing people's hands so they can't ignore or put off these problems any longer. But a lot of these fixes are not glamorous, sexy things. And so it takes a good politician, in a sense, to convince the public, like, this is what we're going to spend your tax dollars on. You know, that's not always an easy thing to do.
Jenny, there are people who think infrastructure can be sexy. I'm talking with WLRN's environment reporter, Jenny Stiletovich. Again, last week, the City of Miami released its Climate Forever initiative, which includes a series of strategies to address things like rising seas and warming climate. All right, so there's also a focus on storms, as we mentioned, really specifically looking at hurricanes. And there's this concern that storms are going to get more intense over the decades with climate change. But what ideas do city leaders have when it comes to protecting our city? One thing that is different is, I mean, it's been a while since Andrew hit. That was the last Category 5.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have high standards, building standards, but are we ready for a Dorian, another Andrew, something like that?
Well, so a couple of things that are going on. One of the big things is the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is doing what they call this back bay study, and that's going to be hardening or providing protection specifically against storm surge. And the county is the partner on that deal. I just talked to Jim Murley about that this morning. They got a briefing on it. But the City of Miami and all the cities around the bay are also going to have a say in what gets built. And some of these changes are fairly dramatic. We've reported on this before. They're talking about floodgates across rivers, but they're also talking about flood walls that would extend out from these gates so that the water couldn't go around. These flood walls would cross major intersections. They would have to have gates that open and close. I mean, we're talking about a massive gray infrastructure. And that said, this is a 3-year planning effort, so it is still there's a lot of discussion to be held and a lot has to be decided about design and placements.
Something that I'm thinking about is the fact that the other thing that's different from when Andrew hit is we have a lot more high rises than we used to. And they've never really been tested, except maybe by Irma, but even then, not really.
Right. And a building code has changed dramatically since Andrew. And if you remember Wilma, you know, I think Fort Lauderdale had some significant damage to some of its high rises. We'll see, I guess. I mean, I think that I shouldn't say always, but more often it's the flood damage that we're concerned about. And so the wind damage, although Dorian, you know,
right,
at a Cat 5, the wind was significant.
No, exactly. We're going to, as something you said, we're going to find out. The other thing too, though, is this, is you talked about it before with me, is when it comes to sea level rise, it's not just water from the ocean. We're surrounded by water. We've got the Everglades on one side, the ocean on the other, and we are sitting on top of water. So water's
Correct.
Coming from all directions. How do they handle that in the plan?
Well, that is the challenge. That is, and Miami is in the midst of drafting a new master stormwater plan, and that's going to have to figure out how do we get groundwater that's being pushed up by rising sea levels, water coming from the west and water coming from the east. Like, how do you deal with that kind of flooding? The city's already installed 50 these kind of gates back. I forget the exact name of them, but to keep when there's tidal flooding to keep
right.
that water from coming up through the storm drains as the tides rise. So it is I think, probably pretty complicated.
We got a question from one of the listeners, Todd from Delray, sent us a question asking, do we know what the projections for how much land could be lost by 2030? Do we know? We have any idea on that?
There have been studies that have estimated the land loss. I could not tell you those numbers off the top of my head, but there's definitely, if you look at the flood maps, they'll tell you what's inundated at what level of sea rise. There's also been studies that have looked at coastal forests that talk mm-hmm. about how much of that gets converted from dry land to wetlands.
And do city leaders ever talk about that reality? We're going to lose some land.
They certainly do in Monroe County.
Okay. You know what? We'll try to find that answer for Todd and post it up on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Again, WLRN's environment reporter, Jenny Stiletovich. Thank you so much, Jenny.
Thank you.
And again, you can read more about the City of Miami's Climate Forever Initiative on our website, WLRN.org. Well, cities like Miami, Key West, West Palm, and Fort Lauderdale receive funds from the state to deal with the aftermath of increasingly more powerful hurricanes. But a new investigation from Politico finds that hundreds of millions of dollars for disaster aid dating back to Hurricane Hermine in 2016 still haven't been distributed. And in parts of the panhandle devastated by Hurricane Matthew and the Florida Keys hit by Irma, that money is desperately needed. Eric Sarkeesian is a reporter for Politico based in Tallahassee. He joins me now. Eric, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Why is money still sitting? And we're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars. Why is it still sitting there? People need it now.
Right. It's actually $891.5 million that is from Hurricane Hermine, Hurricane Matthew, and then Hurricane Irma alone, which, as you know, Hurricane Hermine and Matthew hit the state almost 3 years ago. This is a combination of a lack of institutional knowledge. The state hadn't been hit by a storm in more than a decade, I believe, and also simply the state also negotiating an incredibly uncomplicated program by HUD, and lastly the state just struggling to kind of finally figure it out. Other states had figured out how to get the money out the door after outcry from local lawmakers and residents. The state continued to struggle through the end of 2018.
So the money, we're talking about federal money. This goes through through HUD, but mm-hmm. then what agency in Florida is handling this money that's supposed to distribute this money?
Sure. Here's the process. So every Congress will approve a funding package and will include, say like $2.3 billion for HUD, what's called HUD's. It's a block grant program for disaster recovery. From there, HUD has to basically rewrite rules for the same program. And they have to publish them, and then that from there the states can start applying for it. The federal guidelines require that the state serve as be called as what's known as the grantee. So that's going to be the State Department of Economic Opportunity, which, along with waiting for HUD to actually publish these rules, which has taken progressively longer under the Trump administration, it also has taken the state quite a bit of time to figure out the right way to go about doing this. Again, as other states like North Carolina and New Jersey are cranking out, millions of dollars every month.
So let's say I lose my house in a storm. In an ideal world, what's supposed to happen as soon as I file an application for help?
But it starts before that. The application process has to be offered by the state, and that is actually one of the areas that was actually one of the many sticking points that they faced. HUD has an incredibly long application process that requires studies and different maps and various reports just for the state to have the ability to actually access this money. Then, you as a homeowner can apply for the money. This money is usually the last resort. It's for folks that, their insurance didn't cover any damage or they didn't have insurance. They can't get a loan from the small, from the SBA. That's who this money is meant for. But as of right now, in a lot of cases, the state is just now starting to take those applications for Hurricane Irma. Mind you, that storm hit the state in September of 2017. So it's a long time coming.
You have people and I'm not just homeowners. I'm talking about politicians in these communities saying, just give us the money because we know where it's needed the most. And they're kind of frustrated. Well, they're really frustrated with the bureaucracy in Tallahassee, right? That's basically what's happening.
That is one of the things that I believe is happening in Bay County. Well, the funny part about this story and also was our, we also did an investigation into the money that the state was getting from FEMA, is that a lot of folks don't want to talk badly about the state because you don't bite the hand that feeds you, of course. But folks speaking privately have said, you know, they're, that the state would basically set guidelines and create programs that aren't going to, you know, acutely help the issues of a specific region. In Bay County, who again was not dismissive of the state at all, had said, we just feel like we can do a better job on the ground and address the needs that we need for housing. This program, Get for HUD by HUD standards, this program is actually fairly flexible. It actually has a line in there in the rules that says, hey, if you find a way to use this money as swiftly as possible, just basically ask us for permission, we'll do it. I don't think that the state was making those connections previously. As far as I know, I don't think that they're there yet with Michael. So I think Bay County has actually hired their own contractor and partnered with, you know, some of the cities within Bay County to try and come up with a plan that's going to suit them best.
And you're talking about Hurricane Michael up in the Panhandle. You had, again, Hermine. I mean, we got folks in Monroe County from 2 years ago, more than 2 years ago, with Hurricane Irma still looking for help.
Yep. Yeah. And that's... And those are the people that could, you know, ideally could benefit from this program. You know, there's, I think Hurricane Irma made landfall on September 10th, on Cujo Key. And literally, I've only seen photos, but it's, you know, pretty much wiped out parts of that island. Those are folks who get benefit.
What has the governor or what have state lawmakers said about this and how they're trying to get that money to the people who need it?
Sure. So when Governor Sanders took office a year ago, he brought in Ken Lawson, who at the time was at Visit Florida. Director Lawson was actually at Visit Florida, was brought in there to kind of right the ship after a lot of the controversy over spending and contracts and the Pitbull contract. I'm sure you remember. So by the signaling that Director Lawson's now over at DEO, he was kind of brought in to make a lot of changes. He started to hire folks. He's actually moved their Disaster Recovery Bureau from a sub agency of DEO to actually I think it's right down the hall from his office here in Tallahassee, and he's doing his best to try and fill several positions, and you know, he's also facing the roadblock of, you know, getting the right kind of people, you know, the experts in this program, to come in and step in and get things going.
So basically, the Florida Department of Economic Opportunity, the DEO, as you mentioned, is in charge of this money, almost $900 million, as you said, to try to get it to the communities that need it the most. But you're telling me that they need to hire people because they don't have enough people and the right people to know how to distribute the money.
That's right. Yeah, it's one of the key, I guess. The worst part about a good economy is that it's hard to find people who want to work in state government. Director Lawson's hired a lot of folks. He used to be the secretary of the state's regulatory agency. He hired a lot of his lieutenants from that agency over to help him there, which they have the know-how of running, you know, and getting through the bureaucratic red tape. But this is an insanely complicated program that HUD has. I mean, just imagine having to follow laws that change, you know, every 9 months. Essentially, HUD will rewrite rules, and although they're largely the same, there are little nuances that could, you know, that could basically make or break a budget. It could mean that 10 years down the road, that agency is going to claw back, you know, $10 million because you didn't follow the latest rule, you followed an earlier one. So this is not an easy climb. It's not nearly as easy as the FEMA programs.
Eric Sarkisian is a reporter for Politico Florida. Again, not almost $900 million of disaster recovery money that has not yet been distributed, sitting there. A lot of folks affected by hurricanes over the last couple of years in Florida waiting to get their hands on some of that. Eric, thanks so much for the time.
Thank you for having me.
All right, still to come. City leaders here in South Florida are expecting the Super Bowl to bring in a lot of money for the local economy. We heard from an economist who wants to pump the brakes on the claim. Coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. All right, so what are your plans like for the Super Bowl coming up this Sunday? Are you going to be going out to a friend's barbecue, maybe your favorite local sports bar, maybe you're holding your own big soiree? Miami is gearing up for the tens of thousands of visitors for the game at Hard Rock Stadium who are expected to spend a lot of money while they're here. Projections for last year's Super Bowl in Atlanta suggested hundreds of millions, close to half a billion, generated for the region. But sports economist Victor Matheson argues those numbers are likely over-exaggerated.
Take whatever the boosters are telling you, move that decimal point one place to the left, and that's actually a pretty good estimate of what's really going to happen in Florida.
Professor Matheson has studied the economics of Super Bowls at Holy Cross University for years. I spoke with him last week about who are the real financial winners for the Super Bowl. We spoke with him via Skype last week.
So the way you get an economic impact statement like that is you try to estimate the number of people who come to town for the big game, how much they're going to be spending while they're here, how many days they're going to stay. And then you also apply what's called a multiplier. And a multiplier is when you spend money at a local retailer, and then that retailer spends money at the restaurant, and then that server re-spends money again and again. And that multiplier might then double the initial amount of money that comes into the city in the first place.
You've argued in the past that researchers have the incentive to exaggerate the amount because that it can generate. Why is that?
Well, so there's two reasons why you might want to give an exaggerated number. Number one is sports leagues are often coming hat in hand to try to ask for a big handout when building new stadiums. For example, we had that in Miami a few years ago when you built a new baseball stadium. And of course, there was talk about that with a new Major League Soccer stadium as well. So that's number one. Number two is there are also big expenses and lots of hassles associated with hosting the Super Bowl as well. So you might be asking for money, hundreds of millions of dollars for a new stadium, and you might be asking for tens of millions of dollars to host a big mega event like the Super Bowl.
So do you think that the NFL is using its gravitas to make cities basically compete with each other to host this big game?
So there's no doubt about that. The NFL has very specifically rewarded cities that build new stadiums at big taxpayer expense. That's why we had a Super Bowl recently in places like Santa Clara and places like Minneapolis, new stadiums coming online. And they also realize that there is big money associated with, again, putting on one of these events. It might cost as much as $50 million of direct expenses and of tax exemptions to host the Super Bowl. And the way you get cities to pay that money is by making cities believe there's a huge return to be associated with that.
Do you think Miami maybe benefited from the fact that, you know, they didn't build a new stadium, they had to renovate the old one, and it was on the owner's expense? Taxpayers said, not this time.
Most economists like myself, we're not anti-stadium and we're not anti-Super Bowl, but what we are is anti-taxpayer subsidy for a person's private business. Again, if the owner of the Miami Dolphins or the owner of the Marlins is going to profit from the stadium, then of course they're the ones who should be paying for that stadium. There's no real reason that Miami as a whole and a typical taxpayer should be paying for someone else's business.
As you said, cities have to pay a lot up front. I mean, you got police, infrastructure, so many other things to prepare, just to prepare for the game, let alone all the events, the 2 weeks up to the game. But have we ever found, a situation where the city made less and didn't benefit at all?
Yeah, so that's hard to say because a lot of this stuff is under the table. We don't always get a good accounting. I think most economists would suggest that the Super Bowl is roughly a break even for cities, and cities might actually come out a little bit ahead as long as we don't count in a big expenditure for building a new stadium. And of course, Miami's lucky here that they've been able to host multiple Super Bowls with, you know, just their one new stadium that they built in the late 1980s. So that's actually a pretty good deal. But don't expect a city like Minneapolis to get much of their $500 million stadium investment back just because of a single Super Bowl.
And what about the fact, too, I wonder if Miami is uniquely positioned here. I mean, this is, we get a lot of visitors, especially this time of year. This is really the great time of year because it's not cold down here and the weather is great. Are we better positioned than a Minneapolis or an Atlanta because We're Miami.
That's a good thought, but actually it's exactly the opposite. So when it comes to the economic benefit, you have to decide, well, what's going to happen when the Super Bowl's here versus what would actually happen during a normal day or a normal weekend in Miami. And since Miami's such a good tourist destination in early February anyway, your hotels were likely to be pretty full of tourists with full wallets willing to spend money here. And therefore, the Super Bowl actually displaces a lot of activity that would have occurred anyway. In Minneapolis, where it's not exactly a tourist wonderland in early February, those hotels are not quite as full. And therefore, it's actually better for the city to have a Super Bowl in a Minneapolis than in a Florida, because, again, Minneapolis wouldn't have been full and wouldn't have been at capacity already. And the data actually shows that. So when we look at, for example, the number of additional hotel rooms purchased, in Minneapolis, it was about 60,000 additional hotel room nights due to their Super Bowl a couple years ago. When it came to Phoenix the year before that, the number of additional hotel rooms was only about 30,000. Again, because those Phoenix hotel rooms are pretty full in February, the Minneapolis hotel rooms aren't.
I'm speaking with economist Victor Matheson at Holy Cross University. Matheson is a sports economist that has studied the economic impact of Super Bowls and the cost they can have on cities. Miami is going to be hosting Super Bowl 54 Sunday, February 2nd. And some estimates have hundreds of millions of dollars in expected revenues for the region. One of the more interesting pieces, you started talking about the hotels there. You know, almost all the hotels are going to be charging way above normal prices. Some are in the tens of thousands, I've read. There's even a hotel in Homestead, by the way, which is more than an hour away, that's jacking up prices. But do we get a sense, though, of how that windfall for the hotels is actually being distributed, how locals are going to be feeling that?
Yeah, so that's a great point. That's a perfect example of how money being spent in the city might not actually stick in the city. And this is what economists call a leakage. Yeah, there's no doubt that during the Super Bowl, you get hotel room rates that are three or four times the normal rates. But those same hotels aren't increasing the wages of their room cleaners and their desk clerks by a factor of three or four. So a lot of that money, especially if you've got a national chain for a hotel, that money's not actually sticking in Miami. It is going back to corporate headquarters in New York City. So money's being made, but it's not being made by the city of Miami. If it's Miami that actually has to bear all the burden of the extra, you know, policing and transportation and sanitation, then you have the cost being borne by Miami, but the benefits being borne by someone outside of the city.
So one of the interesting things for us is we haven't hosted a Super Bowl in Miami in a decade. The last time we did, there was no such thing as Uber or Lyft or Airbnb. With Airbnb, we've seen massive price gouging on the site for rooms going for hundreds, if not thousands of dollars. But I wondered what's changed and if there's a benefit here for residents because of the Super Bowl, if they have the opportunity to say, you know, now that all the guests aren't going to the hotels, they might be going to people's homes.
Yeah, so that's actually a good example of a way to maybe keep more of the money in Miami rather than having it leak out through corporate headquarters. But the Uber example is actually a good one and an interesting one. I was in Houston for the Super Bowl a couple years ago, and I had Uber drivers the entire time I was there. About half of my Uber drivers were not actually from Houston. They had come down from Dallas or come down from San Antonio knowing that there was going to be a lot of business. So here's an example, another example, again, of a leakage where there was money spent. I certainly spent a lot of money on Uber rides while I was there, but that didn't stick in the pockets of local Houston drivers because, again, a lot of drivers came in from around the state and around the country to try to capitalize on that. And, again, that's money that's not sticking in the host city but leaving with those drivers when they went back home.
It's no surprise. I mean, mayors will brag about the opportunity to host the Super Bowl. I mean, it's a bragging right. But also, and you've heard this too, they'll say, well, you know what? I mean, it's a lot of attention for my city. You know, that's a lot of free advertising for 2 weeks, constant advertising on television. That's got to be good, right?
So the tourism literature suggests that the biggest way that that you generate tourism is through word of mouth. So I come down to Miami for a spring break or for Christmas, and I have a great time, and I tell all my friends and neighbors what a wonderful time I had in the city. And then, you know, the next year they come themselves. That doesn't seem to happen when we've got big sporting events, because if I come down for the Super Bowl, I don't talk about all the fantastic things that Miami has to offer. I talk about how cool the Super Bowl was and the halftime show was awesome. And, oh, I met John Madden in a restaurant. And then my friends and neighbors say, oh, that sounds great. Maybe I'll go to the Super Bowl sometime. So what a tourist coming to the Super Bowl does is they generate additional visits to future Super Bowls, not necessarily additional visits to those host cities.
You know, people may not realize, if they don't know Miami well, the game itself is not in Miami. Hard Rock Stadium is way outside of Miami's urban core. It's in Miami Gardens. How can the location of a stadium be critical in determining the impact that it's going to have on economic activity, or potentially deterring that activity?
So that really is interesting. We do have some cases like this. We had a similar case in San Francisco when they hosted the Super Bowl a few years ago. The actual stadium is much closer to San Jose. The funny thing is Santa Clara, again, close to San Jose, hosted the game in their stadium, but almost all the additional hotel room nights were up in San Francisco. So it really is a case when you have to determine who has to pay for all the transportation and security, but who is benefiting from the additional hotel, hotel stays, and all the different, hospitality spending that happens when you're there. And that can certainly happen, and Miami wouldn't be the first place where the people are staying a different place than the stadium is.
You know, if I'm an average restaurant owner, bar owner, I'm likely to see a bump in business for the game, and not just from visitors. I'm talking about, you know, from locals who, you know, maybe they're throwing their own Super Bowl parties, and so they want the extra wings and hot sauce and beer. I'm curious if you've looked at how different it is for cities hosting the game, when it comes to these kind of businesses versus just a normal, you know, Sunday, football Sunday.
Well, we know that the Super Bowl, I'm not anti-Super Bowl, just anti-subsidy for Super Bowl. And we know that the Super Bowl is one of the, you know, maybe last great shared social events in the United States. In terms of television viewership, it will be the most viewed TV show in the United States in the year by about a factor of two. There's almost nothing else like this, and it cuts across demographics and it cuts across politics. But while we all have these big parties, it doesn't necessarily mean we're eating that much more, but we're just eating more with more people, right? The Super Bowl isn't necessarily that big a net economic impact, although it's a huge party for the country, because I just eat at my friends and neighbors' houses. I eat all those wings and all that guacamole rather than doing that and having a normal dinner at my house. So there's another example of something that looks big when you look at it in one place. The amount of money spent on Super Bowl parties is huge. But in terms of the total net expenditures that people do at grocery stores, not that much more, because it's not like we would have sat there and starved all day Sunday if there wasn't a big game on.
I wondered if Miami, again, coming back to this idea, Miami is unique in this sense, too. We've now hosted this game more times than any other city. We're now at 10 times, and we're going to pitch to try to host it again in the future. But doesn't that give Miami a little bit of an edge because we've hosted it so many times, so we know this rodeo well?
Yeah, there's no doubt that the NFL really likes Miami as a host. Between Miami and New Orleans, I think they would almost be happy to go and just alternate between the two every year. Obviously, Miami's a great place that the players like to go, the corporate executives like to go. And we know that Miami is used to these sort of events, and so they know they can get the job done. That being said, the NFL really does like to spread this out because it's a very nice carrot to dangle in front of otherwise reluctant taxpayers to say, hey, look how much fun it looked like Miami was having hosting that Super Bowl. Build us a new stadium, and maybe you guys can have a nice Super Bowl party like that, too, in your own hometowns.
Again, that was sports economist Victor Matheson at Holy Cross University. You can hear, and I should say find, more of our reporting on the Super Bowl and the surrounding events by going to WLRN.org. On Thursday, we're going to be speaking with Miami Gardens Mayor Oliver Gilbert about the preparations they're making for the game and what he thinks the game is going to generate for local businesses there. Well, that's our program. That's Sundial for Tuesday, January 28th. Coming up tomorrow on the program, the coronavirus continues to spread across China and spark fears around the globe. Over 100 people have died from the virus now. And we're going to speak with Nova Southeastern University infectious disease experts about the concerns surrounding the virus and whether Miami, a big port town, is at risk. Plus, a group of students from across Florida have filed a lawsuit against the governor and the agriculture commissioner. They're arguing that the state is not doing enough to combat climate change. We're going to hear from local climate activist Delaney Reynolds. That's all coming up on the program tomorrow. Again, because of the impeachment trial, our program is kind of bouncing around. Just find us on social media, WLRN Sundial, for any program changes. I'm Luis Hernandez. Have a wonderful day. We'll talk to you soon.